Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSB Magazine. You're listening to a new Redefining Security podcast. Have you ever thought that we are selling cybersecurity insincerely, buying it indiscriminately, and deploying it ineffectively? Perhaps we are. So let's look at how we can organize a successful InfoSec program that integrates people, process, technology, and culture to drive growth and protect business value. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com.
EdgeScan offers continuous vulnerability intelligence as a service, accurately identifying vulnerabilities and exposures across the full stack. All threats are verified by cybersecurity experts, providing exploitable risk and remediation guidance, virtually false positive free. Learn more at edgescan.com.
Archer empowers organizations to manage multiple dimensions of risk on one platform with on-premises and software as a service offerings, and quickly implement industry standard processes and best practices for advanced risk management maturity, informed decision-making, and enhanced business performance. Learn more at archerirm.com.
Marco.
Sean, what's going on?
Marco, I feel like it's time to redefine stuff.
Yeah? Isn't that what we do all day long?
I think that's what we do all day long.
At least we try. I don't know if we succeed. That's the...
I certainly try. But I feel that we're living with things that, even though they may not be ancient, are kind of old in a way, and may not be keeping up with the times in its own world or in its own sense, but also in the context of business and society. And we're talking about redefining security today, Marco.
Which is kind of weird what you just said, because you would expect that technology, it's always up to speed and changing and moving so fast that almost look like magic. And in some ways, even if it's not too long that we're doing that, we're kind of stuck on certain things. And that's why we decided to talk to people that are either writing books or having talks or thinking about how to redefine where we are and move forward in a different way. And that's exactly what we're going to do today.
Yeah, and it may be, Marco, and we'll find out as we talk.
I don't know.
Exactly. I don't know either. But it may be that because there is so much change, we set things on rails mm-hmm. that we think will be okay on the rails as we try to deal with the new stuff. So let's figure out what that world looks like. We have on our show today a good guy, Tom Krantz. He's an author of a book, helps organizations redefine their security programs, and has a good view, I'm guessing, of where things have come from and where they're headed. So, Tom, welcome to the show. Maybe a few words about your journey to today, what you've been up to.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on. Much appreciated. So I'm a security consultant. I've been kicking around in the industry for about 30-odd years. I actually got started way, way, way back in the early 80s when I was 10, 11 years old. There was dating us all. Luckily it's a podcast, so no one can see the gray hairs. It's much easier that way.
Well, I'm 15 now, so.
That's right. And you're a dog on the internet as well.
Yeah. And I'm a dog, of course.
Yeah, the UK was in the middle of the sort of home computer boom, and the UK government came up with this idea of having a national program of computer literacy. They wanted the UK to be a powerhouse of developers and computer hardware manufacturers. So they teamed up with a national broadcaster, the BBC, and they created a home computer called the BBC Micro that went into everyone's schools. And at the time, my dad was a teacher, so he brought one home. And it was literally just this little beige box with a keyboard you plugged into the TV, and you had a tape recorder, and you had to load games by essentially pressing play on a tape and listening to it shriek and wail. Or you had to type in stuff yourself. It literally came with a manual that taught you how to program and use the computer. And my dad also brought home this excellent bit of kit called a modem, which he said he didn't know how it worked, but apparently you could use it to talk to other computer systems. So long story short, over the next 6 months, I taught myself how the computer work. There were lots of TV programs on at the time teaching you how to connect to other systems and how to get the most out of your home computer. And one of them talked about the equivalent of AOL back in the day. It was run by the UK's telecoms company, British Telecom. It was called Prestel. And it was like a combination bulletin board system, very early email. Prince Charles had an email address. The Prime Minister had an email address. It was pretty cutting edge for the time. And it was also ridiculously expensive. And I was 11. There was no way I could afford to sign up for that. And you had to pay for your local telephone calls as well, which was fairly outrageous at the time. So anyway, I worked out how to dial up some local bulletin boards. I got some connection details for Prestel. I logged into Prestel. And I worked out to get access as one of the BT service engineers. I got admin access to Prestel and set myself up an account and thought that was all really cool. Right up until my dad came home one day and freaked out seeing me logged into Prestel, and I got grounded for the next month. And a couple of months later on, it turns out that there was this thing called computer security, and there were computer security professionals who'd hacked into Prestel and then gone to the press and showed journalists how to do exactly the same thing that I'd sussed out on my own. And the end result of that was BT trying to sue them, and the UK created the Computer Misuse Act. So that was my first introduction to sort of computer security and hacking, and I went on to get a job in the IT industry. I've been doing consulting, building fairly large-scale systems. I've worked with, you know, high-performance computing, silicon graphics systems, fairly large-scale payment processors, and all the way through that, I've been very interested and very active in the security side of stuff. It's one thing to build something; it's completely another thing to work out how you actually keep it running in the face of determined people who want to pull it apart and essentially do what I did with Prestel all those years ago. And so, yes, I've bounced in and around. I've worked with UK government. I've worked with multinationals. I've worked with very small startups. But I've always been driven by where's the interesting work going on? Where's the fun and interesting challenges? And also, where's the interesting stuff in the security space? Who's facing up to some really interesting attacks? Who's got a really difficult security problem with a solution they're building or technology they're using? And it's been a fun and interesting ride. But one of the recurring problems I've come across is that there are some core fundamentals of security. There are some core approaches, and very little is done to sort of educate people around what basic security looks like, how to build a firm foundation of security.
Well, Tom, I'm gonna dig into this with you a bit, because we kind of joked a little bit about it's a fairly new field, but it seems ancient. And we, as a security industry, we have all these new fancy, shiny, blinky things that the marketing teams are trying to sell, and companies are trying to sell to make their investors happy. And then on the other complete opposite extreme side, we say, well, forget all that crazy stuff. Just focus on the basics. And I'm wondering, are the basics good, or are they not able to keep up with the change? I mean, we're not on modems. We're not on bulletin boards. We're in the cloud. We're using APIs and services and all kinds of weird things nowadays.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So the interesting times I had with Prestel all those years ago, that came down to I was able to repeatedly try different usernames and passwords. I was able to brute force my way into the system. And the password that I actually used that the BT service engineer had set up was six twos, 222222. That was their password. And if we look at cloud environments and very modern API-driven applications and API-driven backends to mobile applications, we're still seeing security breaches and flaws where things like user account enumeration, where you keep on going to a banking interface, or as happened a few years back, you keep on going to Apple's iCloud interface and increasing the user account number until you get access to different users and you're logged in. We look at brute forcing passwords, it's still a problem. You look at password complexity, and it's an ongoing thing with people saying, oh, you need to have, you know, for 12 characters. No, you need to have 20 character passwords. No, you need 30 character passwords, and you need to have some Greek letters in there, and you need to have half of the digit pi, and you need to have some Cyrillic alphabet in there. And it all starts to become layers of nonsense, really, because if you look at fundamentally, you know, passwords, password controls, passwords as a security mechanism suck. Right, they sucked in the 80s when people first started using them, and even back then systems didn't even have passwords. We still look at consumer devices now, they have default passwords that everybody knows is. If you're really unlucky, you're working with an ISP who has a default password, but they control your broadband router, so you can't log in and change the default password. And it doesn't have to be this way, right? We've got things like YubiKeys. We've got things like TOTP authentication applications on our mobile phones, like Google Authenticator. We've got password managers that can generate unique passwords that are unique per website, very complicated, and we don't need to remember those passwords. We can use two-factor authentication or security tokens to log into the password manager, and it's secure. It does the job for us. All of these are kind of solved problems, but we're still reading about account enumeration. We're still reading about account takeovers because you increased your account number by one digit. We're still reading about default passwords allowing people to go in. We're still reading about things like Amazon S3 buckets that don't have any passwords on them, that are just wide open to the internet. And those to me are not just fundamental security basics. You know, those are things that we should not be seeing at all. But they're things that have been solved for many, 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 many years. And it doesn't matter how much sort of security technology you buy or how great the product is. If people aren't tackling things like those, the real fundamental basics, the same problems that led to wide-scale security breaches 40 years ago, we're still doing them today. Another good example is the OWASP Top 10. If we look at the OWASP Top 10, it's not changed for donkey's years. And the reason it's not changed for donkey's years is not because OWASP and everyone who works with them is sitting on their hands. It's because the problems are still there. We're still seeing
donkeys are writing code. That's why.
Yeah, there's just lots of this stuff where there are things that are solved, but people aren't implementing the solutions and they're not tackling the right problems. You know, the number of times I hear people talking about, oh, yeah, we know we're vulnerable to cross-site scripting. We know SQL injection is a problem with our application, but it doesn't matter. We're going to buy a web application firewall. It's just like, well, how about you do input checking on your web forms? That's not hard. And web development frameworks will do that for you out of the box. And if we're doing agile development and cloud-native development, we can build all that into your CI/CD tool chain, right? Test-driven development, testing for security is just as valid as testing for functionality issues or software bugs, right? We should be doing all that. And people aren't. And one of the things I've run across while consulting for lots of different clients is that, yeah, sometimes you come across people who are saying, yeah, okay, I know it's a problem, but I'll fix it next month. It'll go in the backlog. We'll deal with it later on. We'll deal with that when we tackle the rest of our technical debt. But the majority of people still don't understand that this stuff is possible, that it's been solved. And certainly when you get to the executive team level, to the people who are making business decisions, there's very little education at that level. There's very little support at that level to help them, you know, understand what's going on. And a lot of that is, we used the words earlier on, arcane, right? It's the subtle wizardry of cybersecurity. It's like IT is a discipline, but security is an art. And it's nonsense, right? If you can't stand up and say to your board and your executive team, this is the problem, this is what causes it, and this is what we're going to do to fix it, then you probably don't know enough about security to be implementing security policies or buying security tooling.
So education. Tom, let me ask you something, because this is a very philosophical conversation in a way that then it bleed into business and the value of security for business. Where did this start? Why it is arcane? Why do you need to write a book, and as you, many others, to make sense of cybersecurity, to try to explain something that it should already be making sense by now, 30, 40 years later. What blocked this? I mean, is there been a problem in the practitioners that wanted to keep it arcane, kind of like we know magic, you don't, and we keep control? Or there's been a refuse from other area of the business to want it to know more and understand that security is part of the business? What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think it's, or certainly my experience consulting with different size clients over the years has been that it's a combination of factors. So partly there's the whole job security, I need to get budget. It's very difficult to explain the impact of security, right? If you're doing a good job as a cybersecurity practitioner, nothing changes. Everything still works. You're completely invisible. It's not until you do a bad job or you get a hack that everyone suddenly turns around and says, what have we paid you for? Where's all this money gone? Why haven't you done it? Right? It's a bizarre situation to be in. And so naturally, people in cybersecurity are, they view themselves as scapegoats, rightly or wrongly. And there is a attitude adjustment that needs to happen across the business there. And we've been seeing that over the last few years. But there's a natural inclination there. You know, it's a precarious position to be in. You're doing a good job. No one knows who you are or why you're doing or why they're spending money on it. So, you know, naturally, people tend to be forced into this position of being quite defensive and picking it up. I have a good friend who used to work at GCHQ, the UK spy agency. So when he hears this, he'll be laughing because I'll point my finger directly at the spy agencies. You know, they are the classic example of security practitioners who stand there going, well, you know, if you knew what I knew, if you knew the dangers hackers posed, you know, you should be wetting the bed in fear, and I need a budget of 20 million. And if you don't give it to me, hackers will steal your babies and torch your car. You know, it's from security services and governments downwards. And then that's also another factor that feeds into that is the IT industry itself. If we look at the evolution of, say, antivirus has gone from, okay, you kind of need it, through to, okay, it's gotten invasive now, through to now it's not antivirus, right? It's endpoint protection with artificial intelligence and machine learning. It's nothing of the sort, right? It's still antivirus. It's still looking for signatures. It's still scanning memory. It's still doing stuff. But the only way that industry has been able to keep on upselling and selling subscriptions and selling more and more copies of their software and keeping the industry going is by this whole culture of FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, you know, making people scared. If you can't...
I remember 20X years ago, Tom, I was working for a vendor who likes the color yellow, and there was a lot of discussion around the AV client is so silent, nobody knows it's working. And there was a move to push for alerts presented to the consumer so they know that it was actually working. And then, of course, the consumers got alert fatigue, right? And the businesses that use the enterprise version got alert fatigue. So it's a balance of being aware of what's happening, understanding what's happening, but being fatigued or overwhelmed by that information versus doing things that perhaps don't even put you in that position in the first place. So kind of mitigating some of the risk before it's even exposed.
Yes. And I think some of this is driven by the history of some of the security products. You know, it's if we look back at the 90s in particular and the PC revolution, you know, the desktop PC landscape, especially when they started to be connected up by the internet, it was a disaster zone, right? It was security was so shockingly bad. And it wasn't until groups like the Loft started to publicly embarrass organizations like Microsoft that they started to take security seriously. So a lot of the big security vendors have their history in consumer-facing desktop applications. Some of the best security tools I've seen have been very silent at the endpoint, but they present a really, really great set of information reports to the administrators to then take to senior management, you know, stuff that very easily explains, okay, we saw this many attacks and we automatically blocked this many and this many needed manual intervention. That gives you a great overview about how effective your security is, what percentage of attacks were able to be stopped automatically, which ones required manual intervention and why they required manual intervention. You know, that's great actionable data to be taking to your management team, to the team who are going to be giving you funding and saying, look, you know, it's our software is only mitigating 50% of the attacks on our endpoints. We need to invest in either better software, or we need to look at a better way of doing this, or we have, you know, some outdated software on the endpoints that we need to update, whatever. But it gives you actionable data. Whereas I think a problem with a lot of these tools, and I've seen it in corporate environments, I don't want to unfairly pick on the company who likes the color yellow, but I too have worked extensively with them. And the endless stream of pop-ups, you're absolutely right. It's alert fatigue. It's you're trying to get work done, and you've got this thing popping up in the bottom right corner of your screen squealing about, I've seen this, I've blocked that, I've done this, I've done that. Who cares, right? I'm just trying to get work done.
Let's talk a little bit about that and transition it to kind of the maturity of a security organization, InfoSec organization, and a program. And I know in preparing for this, you mentioned frameworks and standards. And do the use of those help companies be more mature, or how are they presenting themselves as being mature? I tackled 500,000 alerts today, therefore we're successful and we must be mature because we know what's going on and we've blocked all those threats or those attacks. What's the definition of maturity? Tactical versus strategic, frameworks, models, thoughts on that?
Yes. So there's a couple of good ways of measuring maturity. The usual one I like is the one that comes up a lot, where you start, you know, level one is it's utter chaos. No one really knows what they're doing. Everything is ad hoc. And level five is nirvana, right? Everything is purely automated. Your IT support teams and your security teams spend all their days on the beach because everything is automated. It fixes itself. Everyone knows what the process is. Everyone does their job automatically. And that's a really good scale to sort of measure stuff, because very often you see consultancies come into organizations and say, right, we've got these really great security frameworks. You need to implement this. You know, I've seen a lot of people come in and going, you need to use SAPSA. That's a really great security framework. It'll enable you to articulate your infrastructure and your organizational processes in security language. This is awesome. If things are like at a low level of maturity, where people don't understand the process, where you don't have consistent password management, where people don't know how to report a security incident, where any response to security is always ad hoc and people having to think on their hands and there's no documentation, you know, frameworks aren't going to help there. It's far more fundamental than that. And when I talk about getting back to the basics, it's you know, that sort of thing. Do people understand, if I get a suspicious email coming in, do I know what I need to do with it? You know, do your people understand the process? How do they report that to your security function? Does your security function know what to do with it when they get it? There's no point buying, you know, anti-phishing software. I worked with a client recently who had spent a small fortune outsourcing phishing activities, and they were regularly sending phishing emails to their staff to test their response, and they were getting huge failure rates. It was 90 to 100% of those phishing emails were successful every single time across the entire organization. And they were complaining about it and saying, well, you know, people are just clicking on links. It's like, okay, great. Have you told them not to? Have you taught them why clicking on those links is bad? Have you taught them what they should be doing if they get an email that they think is suspicious? How do they know it's suspicious? What should they do with it? How do they report it? And they did an about face. They went from paying for automated phishing emails to internal workshops, to actually talking to their end users, their executive team, the people who are most at risk, and explaining how phishing worked, getting them to understand how hackers use phishing attacks to break into an organization. At which point people are like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. You know, it's end users, non-technical people aren't stupid. It's just they're not technical. They don't have to be. It's not their job. It shouldn't be expected of them. I don't expect my dog to be able to change a tire on my car. It's just not fair on my dog, right? And to be honest, the tires are quite big. If we look at an organization, you know, if you've got people in the finance department, why should they innately know about cybersecurity or know how computers work or know how hacking works? You know, it's getting back to the basics is about actually making sure that these people understand, okay, you're a threat. You're at risk from these type of attackers, and they will do these things to you. So you need to look out for this, this, and this. And it's not a one-shot deal, right? We should be regularly doing this, regularly talking to our users and educating them and making them understand how this stuff works. Only in when you've got people understanding, okay, if I see something suspicious, I need to go and talk to this team over there who will do this, 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 and this, and I know it's dealt with. Then you can start looking at more serious frameworks.
Right. But first you need to know what is suspicious, and that's the whole key, right? If you keep the information for yourself and then you come out from the wood just to point the finger and say, oh, you screwed up, that's why you need us.
If you come out from the woods, that's suspicious.
I know, but you know, from the your high, you know, it's kind of like I'm imagining, I don't know, this shaman, you know, or this magician from in the Middle Ages. That's why I thought that we, you know, I go very storytelling with my stuff. So anyway, and you just come out instead of say, look, don't make me point the finger next time. But the truth is, I love pointing fingers, and I feel this industry, it just love pointing fingers. So I feel like you need to make sense of cybersecurity as the title of your book in order so that everybody embrace and jump on this train from the business, from the financing, the legal department, the HR, and down to the lower level, the work in the company. I mean, I hate to say things that we heard a million times, but if everybody is a little bit more secure, the entire company is more secure. So tell me a little bit about the book, and who did you have in mind when you wrote it? Is it to tell security people, let's change what we do? Or is it to tell the business people, look, this is what you need to do to understand what we do? So who is it for?
Yeah, so it's aimed for non-security people. It's to help them understand the most common security issues, and not just, oh, you know, this is why you need encryption, this is why you need antivirus, but to help them understand this is how hackers think. This is, you know, when I do a pen test, when it's a physical penetration test or an application penetration test, you know, I'm working with clients, constantly in the back of my mind is, oh, that's a really great solution there. How do I break it? How do I make it go wrong? How do I get into it? And that hacker mindset, how do I pull this apart? How do I understand how it works? How do I put it back together in a different way so it does something different? Now, in many ways, that's the complete opposite of the developer mindset, where a developer is given a problem and they have to solve the problem. They have to fix something. They have to build something. And it can be a very difficult mindset for people to put themselves into. So the book is about educating people on the most common hacking attacks, not just, oh, yeah, here's how SQL injection works, but why, as an attacker, would I use SQL injection against your website? What do I get out of it? How do I then use that? I was talking to some hedge fund executives at an insurance meetup in London, and one of them came over to me, and he said, so you're in security? And I was like, yeah. Do a bit of hacking, bit of consulting. What would you like to know? And he said, so I was reading in the press that the dark web can hack my laptop. What should I do? And I was like,
the dark web?
The dark web.
Mr. Dark Web?
That lives in the forest, by
the way. That lives in the forest, exactly.
And it's, you know, at one level, as technology people, we can listen to something like that and laugh. But another level, it's just like, why is no one helping this person?
Mm-hmm.
So I gave a seminar to a bunch of hedge fund executives, and basically said, okay, here's what the dark web is. Here's how it works. Here's how I as an attacker would use it. Here's how I communicate on it. Blah blah blah. And then said, you know, but enough talking. Let's do a live demo. And on screen, took them to a dark web marketplace. We looked at some knocked off Ukrainian tanks that were for sale. We looked at some rocket launchers that we could have bought over the dark web. And up until then, you know, no one had explained to these people, hugely high net worth individuals who were massive, massive targets for hackers. I mean, just from financial fraud alone, these people were great, great targets. But no one had bothered to explain to them what role the dark web could have in terms of planning an attack or laundering any assets or proceeds from a breach that could affect their companies. They had no idea. And once I took them through and explained it to them, they, you know, they're smart people, right? They got it completely. And they not just got it, they were really interested in it. They understood how threats could utilize the dark web to attack their organizations and to disseminate stolen assets from their organizations. I mean, one of them wanted to actually get his checkbook out and buy a Ukrainian tank, which is a bit of a problem at the time. But the rest of them... The rest of them understood the concept of the dark web. He got excited
about it. Oh, he was where it is. I've been looking for that.
He was just like, wait, hang on. I can pay. I can pay $20,000 and I can have an actual tank.
I hope somebody from the Monty Python is listening to this, because this is such a Monty Python sketch right here.
But you talk to lots of technology people, and not just security people, and they go on about how, you know, executives don't really understand technology, and they're all about the business and the strategy, and they don't understand how this stuff works, and they don't understand the importance of good technology and good security. The flip side is that no one's actually helping them understand this stuff. No one's getting into it. You look at trade fairs and trade shows, and the IT industry and the security industry is all about, oh, you're going to get hacked. You know, like the guy said, the dark web's going to hack my laptop. You know, he's picked that up from a trade show or the industry press. And it's dangerously misleading stuff. But where is he going to find out the truth? Where is he going to understand the context of that threat? And that's what drove me to write the book, really. You know, talking to lots of people across the industry over the years and working with lots of clients, no one has really broken down security in easy to understand language and moved away from the frameworks and the complicated algebraic formulas for calculating risk. It's like, really, who cares, right? You're an executive, you're running a business, you need to allocate budget. Do I care if risk equals threat times vulnerability, or is there an impact in there? What does that formula like? No one gives a monkey's, right? And if you're trying to explain that to an executive team or a board, you're going to get kicked out. They're far too busy for that. You've got to make it real for them. And I've found over the years that lots of people struggle with that, because communicating technology within security is very easy for us because we're technologists. We've done nothing but technology and security. Stepping outside that comfort zone and trying to communicate the concepts to people who are not technology orientated, who are not security orientated, can be very difficult. But I would say it's one of the single greatest things we can do to help people understand the threats and the risks and the security issues that we face on a daily basis. Because once they understand, you know, no one is going to be sitting there saying, oh, I understand that we're at serious risk from criminal gangs because we deal in high transactional financial services. But I'm not going to give you any budget to deal with that because, you know, I've got better things to do. No, right? You don't get budget when people don't understand. And they're just like, why are you buying more of this software? How does it make us safe? I've not seen any output from it. If you help them understand the underlying issues and help them understand why we need to do these things, because these are the problems we face, if they understand it, you find that the executive team and the rest of the business are not just supportive, they're willing participants in any security program. They want security to succeed because they understand how it impacts them. And for many security programs and for many security professionals, you know, we're not doing that education and communication.
So, Tom, I think as we begin to wrap here, the bottom line for me is executives probably hear this stuff, don't know what to ask, of whom to ask it, what to do with the answer if they do find somebody to give them an answer. And I mean, we've gone from donkey slinging code to hacking dingoes stealing babies to dogs changing tires to I don't know, wizards in the forest telling stories.
You've been paying attention.
I've been paying
attention. Wow, I'm surprised. So,
I mean, can anybody make sense of this conversation? This is probably what it sounds like, technology security talk to business folks. So I guess the bottom line for me is having a real conversation about what it is, why it matters, what's the impact of the business in a way that they can understand. I mean, that's what we try to do on Redefining Security, is understand how this stuff impacts the business. Sounds like your book, Tom, will help with at least connecting the initial dots to, well, what are the stories I should be looking at? What are the scenarios that should be of interest to me? How can I understand those scenarios so I can ask the right questions? And then, of course, it's finding the right folks to have those conversations with to get those questions answered. But I think, to me, it sounds like your book is a good starting point for a lot of individuals and business leaders to start having that initial understanding of what's going on.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, that's exactly what I'm aiming for. It's you know, we talk about making sense of cybersecurity. We talk about getting back to the basics, and it's those sort of things. It's just like who is going to attack you? Why? What would they do? What's the most common ways that they would do it? And at least if people can start understanding that, it gives them a shared language. It gives them an ability to actually talk in a meaningful way to security technologists. And you know, it's like these hedge fund execs, you know, it's a follow-up session I had with them was, okay, we get how the dark web works. So this Bitcoin thing, how does Bitcoin work? And we're able to dive quite deeply into not just the functionality of Bitcoin, but how it worked in their financial services world as well. And they very quickly got the concepts and things, but having an initial grounding of some of the basics, having some shared reference points to talk about is always the best way to open up those conversations and start improving communication and education. But we've got to start somewhere. Obviously, I'd like it if everyone started with my book, clearly. But
well, absolutely. And I think the one thing, and we'll close with this, Marco, is clearly those hedge fund managers found the value in understanding, and they made an investment to have those conversations with you. And they probably spent more time afterwards trying to figure out, okay, now that we know this, what do we do with this information? So clearly they found the value in that, made an investment of time, perhaps made an investment afterwards to respond to what they learned. And I think that's the ultimate goal for us, is to understand the value of understanding, the value of security to the business. Not as a blocker, but as an enabler. And so with that, Marco, any final thoughts?
Nope, I'm going back in the wood.
You're going back in the wood. I knew it was you.
No, I mean, you guys say as many things that make sense from a psychological and sociological perspective too. Like when you keep things, and this is the fear of the unknown. If you keep people in the unknown, they're going to be fear, and you're driving with the things that cybersecurity unfortunately has been driving with for a long time. And that's not the way to improve. And I think that's the bottom line, really. Yeah. So with that said,
I want to thank you, Tom, for, yeah, most definitely appreciate the chat and the stories, and many more in your book. We'll include links to that, Tom, for folks that are listening. And, I want to thank everybody for joining us for this Redefining Security, and Tom for joining us to help us do that.
Oh, thank you very much indeed. That's much appreciated, and I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Archer empowers organizations to manage multiple dimensions of risk on one platform with on-premises and software as a service offerings, and quickly implement industry standard processes and best practices for advanced risk management maturity, informed decision-making, and enhanced business performance. Learn more at archerirm.com.
EdgeScan offers continuous vulnerability intelligence as a service, accurately identifying vulnerabilities and exposures across the full stack. All threats are verified by cybersecurity experts. providing exploitable risk and remediation guidance, virtually false positive free. Learn more at edgescan.com.
Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Redefining Security Podcast. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share itspmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.